It's a Jewish festival this week on The Good Life, here on ABC Radio with me, Noel Debien. Back in 1946, on October the 16th, a Nazi war criminal and a very nasty anti-Semite by the name of Julius Streicher was hanged by the neck until dead by Allied forces. Streicher had been the publisher of a Nazi weekly newspaper called Die Stürmer, The Attacker, and in it he wrote lots of very virulent anti-Jewish propaganda. At the Nuremberg trials, Streicher was reported in the judgment against him as Jew beta number one. That was his reputation. Well, before Julius Streicher was hanged, he called out something very surprising. He called out, in German, Purim Festival, 1946. Well, Streicher's bitter words were not surprising for those who know a little bit about the Jewish festival of Purim. According to the Bible, Purim recalls both the hanging of a great enemy of the Jews, but also the survival of the Jews of Persia from genocide. And in this week of the festival of Purim, the Jews recall a queen of Persia, Esther. And Iranian Jews of the present day actually consider themselves the descendants of Queen Esther. Her historicity is a little bit elusive, but while historians continue to look for more precise evidence of exactly when she lived, Queen Esther is nevertheless well remembered in the Bible, in the book named after her, the Book of Esther. Well, The Good Life set out this week to find out why a Persian queen's personal bravery might be a source of bitterness for a Nazi war criminal, but might also become a source of great determination and purpose among modern Jews.
Hi, I'm Donna Jacob-Seif. I'm Jewish. I've been a Jewish educator for a long time. I'm a professional storyteller, and I now work for an organization called Together for Humanity, which is a diversity education organization.
Donna, Purim, it's perhaps not the most important Jewish festival, but it is an important Jewish festival. It's a story of early genocidal intention, isn't it? It revolves around some key people, Esther being one of them. Tell us the story of Esther and how this relates to the Jewish people surviving.
Okay, so this is the story. There was a man, a king called Ahasuerus, who really liked a good party. No one could deny it. He had a party for about 7 days, and on the seventh day, being completely drunk, it was only a men's party, and his wife, Queen Vashti, was having a party for women. He called Queen Vashti to the party that he was having to wear a crown before the men, which really means, in brackets, not to wear anything else. And Vashti said no. And this was, you know, unheard of, and the men were in an uproar. They said to King Ahasuerus, "What if your queen says no to you, and you're the king? Imagine what our wives are going to say to us." And so he did two things. First of all, he killed Vashti for having said no. And secondly, he told every man that they had a right to be the authorities in their own household. So that also leaves King Ahasuerus without a queen, and he felt a little miserable about that. So very wisely decides to choose his queen in a beauty contest. So he gets all the young maidens to come, and he's going to choose who would be his favorite queen. While this was going on, there was a guy called Mordechai who also worked in the palace, and he was the uncle of a very beautiful young girl called Hadassah, was actually her name. He said to her, "This is what you've got to do. You've got to go with these young maidens, as you've been decreed to, so that the king can choose, but promise me you will not reveal that you're Jewish. In fact, your name shall now be Esther," which was actually a Persian name, which means hidden. So Esther went amongst all the other young women, and they spent months and months scenting themselves and perfuming themselves, and all had private audience with the king. And when it was Esther's turn to meet the king, he was so incredibly besotted, she immediately became Queen of Persia, incredibly powerful, and that was the end of that. Meanwhile, Mordechai, who kept an eye on Esther since he was in the palace, he overheard two men plotting to kill the king. He actually was a linguist. He understood many languages. And he went to the king and to Esther and told them what he had heard. And the king, very grateful, first of all, had those two plotters hung and then put in his book of good deeds, which he wrote in most nights, "Mordechai saved my life today." The book was closed, put away, nothing was heard of it again. So Esther's living in the palace and Ahasuerus is there. And then Ahasuerus makes another terrible error. He wasn't the wisest of kings. He chose to be his prime minister, Haman. Haman was this kind of grotesque figure who was overwhelmed with his own power. And the rule was, the decree was that he insisted the king pass, was that everyone who saw Haman in the streets had to bow down to him. And Mordechai, when he saw Haman in the streets, just didn't bow down to him. And Haman was so outraged, he said, "Who is that Jew, that man?" And his followers all said, "That's Mordechai." He said, "Then I shall kill all of them." All the Jews were going to get killed. So he gathered all his men together, and they took out of lots, like a lottery, the day and the month. In fact, Purim means lots. The day and the month that he was going to kill the Jews. And it ended up being the 13th in the month of Adar. On that day, the Jews were going to be wiped out in Persia. And he went to the king, and the king, who was just sort of signing this, signing that, I imagine, Haman said, "Look, there is a scattered strange people, and you should really, they don't follow the laws of the king, and you should wipe them out." And the king, hardly listening, I don't think, took off his signet ring and had it sealed. And so it was done, this edict to kill the Jews. When Mordechai heard about this edict, he went into deep mourning. He went into sackcloth and he put ashes, all the things that one does when they're in deep mourning, because he knew what he had to do, and it broke his heart to do it. And he went to Esther, his niece, the queen, and said, "Listen, there's only one thing can be done here. You've got to go to the king and beg him to save the Jews. You've got to reveal yourself as a Jew." Now, the queen and everybody knew that if you go to the king without being summoned, it is punishable by death. And so the queen, Esther, knew that this was really possibly her end. And she said, "I'll do it, but I want you to ask every Jew in Persia to fast and to pray with me." And so that was what happened. For 3 days, Esther fasted and prayed, and so did all the Jews in Persia. And then on the third day, she dressed herself and anointed herself with oil and went down the corridor to the king's chamber. And she put her hand on the door and she says, "Well, if I die, I die." And she opens the door and there is the king. Now the sign was, if the scepter pointed down to the ground, she was going to die. But if the scepter pointed to her, she would live. And so all eyes in the king's court were on this scepter. And sure enough, it rose up towards Queen Esther, and she knew that she would be safe. And he said, "My darling queen, what do you want? You can have half my kingdom if you want." And she said, "Really, all I want is a party with you and Haman." They have a party. And the king says to Esther, "Okay, my darling, what is it you want? You can have half my kingdom if you want. I can see there's something on your mind." And Esther said, "I want another party." And the king says, "Another party? Marvelous. With you and Haman," she says. "Fine, it'll be done." So they leave the party. Haman is full of hubris and joy to think that he is in this inner sanctum of royalty. And he goes out to start the gallows, to build the gallows to hang Mordechai, who he cannot bear the sight of. He can't wait till the 13th of Adar. And then the second party comes the next night. But before that, on that night, the king can't sleep. And what always helps him sleep is the Book of Good Deeds. It's kind of a boring book, I guess, and it puts him to sleep. So he calls one of his servants over and says, "Read me the Book of Good Deeds." And, you know, it just happens to open on the page that Mordechai had saved his life, that entry. And the king said, "Did I ever honor that man? And they said, no, I don't think he did, Your Majesty. So he said, oh, bring Haman to me. So Haman is disturbed from making the gallows, comes to the king. The king says, how would you honor a man who the king wanted to honor? And of course, Haman thinks it's about him, thinks everything's about him. And so he says, well, if I was going to honor the man that you wanted to honor, I would bring him in royal robes and I would take him on a white horse and I would take him down the streets and say, this man is being honored by the king. And the king said, marvelous, tomorrow you do that for Mordechai. Ah. So that's what Haman has to do, dress him up, take him on the, and you can imagine how it felt. But anyway, at least he had the party that night. So that night there was a party again, and once again Ahasuerus could see Esther's got something deeply on her mind. He says, tell me, I know my darling queen, what is wrong? I will give you half my kingdom, what do you want? And she said, husband, king, I am a Jew, and there is an edict that on the 13th of Adar, all the Jews of Persia are going to be destroyed. And the king is shocked, even though it's his own ring that sealed it. And he said, who would do such an evil thing? And Esther points to Haman and says, him. And Haman rushes over and throws herself on Esther, probably falls on her. The king says, you dare to attack my wife in front of me, has him dragged off and is hung on his own gallows. Now, you can't change an edict. You can't change something that's already been sealed by the king. So the king said to Mordechai and Esther, I can't change this edict, but what I will do is you can have any extra edict you want. And so an edict was put out that all the Jews were going to be armed and could defend themselves on the 13th of Adar. And that's what happened. Many Jews died and did lose their lives, but in the end, the Jews were victorious and they were not destroyed. And Mordechai and Esther became the queen and the prime minister of Persia, and there were happy years to follow.
This story, how is it still remembered and how is it still celebrated? Because this program that we make, The Good Life, is about practical spirituality. The telling of the story is one thing.
You do have to hear the story. That is part of the laws of Purim. There are four things that you have to do. You have to have a feast. You have to hear the story. You have to give mishloach manot, which is gifts full of different foods to each other. And you have to give to the poor. You have to give money to the poor. They're the four ways of celebrating Purim.
So the Megillah Esther, the scroll itself, is read out in the synagogue?
It needs to be read in Hebrew, of course, because there's something about the sacred language that you have to hear. So what I often am sorry about is that the story is not then told in English necessarily. So it's almost a mystical thing that you have to hear the words of the Megillah.
I recall once being at Melbourne University when the Megillah was actually taken into the university. It was a big deal. It was a big reading for the students. The Lubavitchers were conducting a mission, and it was on Purim, and they were reading the scroll. So it was almost seen as like a, I suppose, Jewish evangelism.
It's fulfilling a mitzvah, fulfilling a commandment. They must do it. You know, they're making sure that any Jew that can get their hands on are going to hear the Megillah read, because that is the commandment of Purim. So that's what they're fulfilling.
Now, second to that, as an outside observer, and I'm sure you can shed more light on it, you've told us what the four things are, the four mitzvot, the four commandments. I was once again in Melbourne and at a very large Jewish school, beautiful Jewish school, and it was Purim, and the kids were having this festival. Now, they were all in costume, and they were actually acting out this story. It was a really big deal.
Well, there are lots of things that we do in Purim. First of all, we wear masks, because the real essence of Purim is that it's a story of miracle, and yet who is hidden more than anyone else? God. There's no mention of God. And so what can it mean that this festival that talks about miracles has hidden God, the one being who can give you miracles? So everything is hidden in the story. You know, Esther's own, you know, identity had to be hidden. The plot to destroy the king was hidden and then was revealed, and then Esther revealed. So hidden and revealed are very important themes. It's the hidden hand of God in everything. That this may look like a disaster to you, but have faith, because providence is having its way and you may not see it. So we wear masks, but also there's this topsy-turvy thing in Purim where, you know, Ahasuerus, who's this total misogynist at the beginning of the story, ends up being completely committed letter to Queen Esther and doing whatever she wants. And with Haman, of course, he wants to gain power, destroy the Jews, and he ends up being hung on his own gallows. And it's Mordechai and Esther who get the power, not Haman. Everything is not as it seems. And there is this great sort of blending, if you like, of a sort of a non-polarized view of the world. Even when we're celebrating, we have to obliterate the name of Haman by making a lot of noise, and so we don't hear his name.
At this assembly, what was sort of an assembly and a play, every time they said the name of Haman, the kids started stamping. If they had, you know, rattles that they turned around, there was this enormous noise in the room every time the word Haman was said.
It's kind of cathartic. It's a very cathartic festival as well. You know, there have been times, I don't know if you know, that the Jews have wanted to be have been obliterated from time to time. And this is a festival that just sort of empowers Jews and sort of, you know, you poke your tongue out at the enemy, that we stamp our feet, we rise up in one voice. And just like the Jews of Persia who all fasted and prayed for Esther, so do we join together and rise up in victory against the enemy.
In preparing for this and trying to, you know, make sure that I knew enough about it, I read that straight after Kristallnacht, the first thing that Adolf Hitler did was ban Purim. It was forbidden in Germany for the Jews to celebrate it. Now, why would he go after that festival, do you think?
Well, that's a scary thought, you know, because it shows great understanding of what Purim is about, I think, because it is a unifying festival. It's one that, you know, we do rise up together as one.
Well, it was a lot of fun that I was observing, I've got to say. The kids obviously enjoyed it, and the teachers and parents who were in the room and the aides, they were right into it. They were making sure those kids knew this story and they were really involved in it.
It is the funnest festival, actually, and it has to be. It's full of mirth. It really is a reminder that when terrible events occur, to have faith. That's really what it's about, that if you maintain your faith, something will emerge that will, you know what people always say, it's always for a good reason, or it's everything happens for a reason. Purim is very much about that, and it's a deeply mystical festival, actually.
Now, I also saw cross-dressing, Jewish cross-dressing, including Orthodox men wearing women's clothing. Now, that's not something I would have expected.
No, it's the one day in the year where we're allowed to cross-dress, and that's why it's always, you know, it's around the time of Mardi Gras, and I always think it's so appropriate that the entire Sydney is celebrating Purim.
The other thing I did see also in this Hasidim household, so very Orthodox Jews, I mean, really serious, took their Judaism very seriously. Very surprisingly, there would have been maybe 20 people at this very long table. It was a beautiful lunch. It was a real festival lunch. But I noticed out came spirits, hard spirits, and they drank. Some of the rabbis didn't. Some of the older and more conservative Jewish people didn't. But some of the conservative people certainly did, until I could start to see a few cross eyes in the room, and it got louder, and it was outrageous. And I honestly don't associate Jews with drinking too much. That's just not something I ever noticed among my Jewish friends.
No, but what you would have noticed amongst your Jewish friends is that we use wine and alcohol for ceremonial purposes. That's one of the reasons why Jews don't necessarily drink a lot. In fact, there's a little saying which says a fool is one who's drunk every day of the year except Purim. So we are encouraged to get drunk so that you can't tell the difference between Mordechai and Haman, which means that you don't know what's good and you don't know what's bad. You just don't know. You can't be sure of anything, you know.
It strikes me almost like the Jewish Saturnalia, where everything's reversed, steam is let off. This is like the pressure valve of the year. And off you go. Is that a fair observation?
It is, but they also say that Purim will be the only festival that we celebrate after the Messiah comes. You don't know what's right or wrong or what's good or bad or what's man or woman. There is this sort of blending of something that goes beyond this world into the next in a way, and I think that that might be why we celebrate it. It's the only one we celebrate after the Messiah comes.
אני פורים, אני פורים, שמח ומבדח. הלא רק פעם בשנה אבוא להתארח. לא 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 לא.
היי דת פורים, היי דת פורים, הקוטוף ומצלתיים, או מי איתנו בפורים לחודש לחודשיים.
דודי פורים, דודי פורים, הם בונה לי מדוע, מדוע לא יחול פורים פעמיים בשבוע. לה 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 la 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 la